Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Our engineer and producer is Patricia Colburn. We have three fascinating guests this morning. A defeated presidential candidate. No, not that one. A radical doctor and political activist from India. And a local nurse who draws on novels to help imagine a fundamentally different system of healthcare. Before turning to them, I want to remind you that KBOO's spring membership drive is winding down. If you're able, please become a sustaining member or at least make a one-time donation. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44-321 or send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We lead off today with Dr. Swati Birla. Patricia Colburn talks with her about the coronavirus crisis in India, not just its devastation, which other news media cover, but the political context that's made it disastrously worse and is taking advantage of it to cement right-wing rule. Patricia?
This is Patricia Colburn for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And today I have a special guest with us to talk about the pandemic in India. It was only a few months ago that Prime Minister Narendra Modi was boasting on the world stage about how India had defeated the coronavirus, suffering relatively few cases of the disease compared to most other countries. India also has the single largest vaccine manufacturing facility in the world and was churning out COVID vaccine and shipping it off to poor countries around the globe, deploying vaccine diplomacy. But this moment of political triumph for the right-wing populist leader vanished over a matter of weeks as India experienced an unprecedented surge of COVID cases. Today, what we read out of India is absolutely horrific. The healthcare system is on the verge of collapse. Bodies of victims are washing up on the banks of the Ganges River. In cities and towns, the skies are full of smoke from the cremation of so many deceased. To talk about the significance of the situation in India, I have with me today Dr. Swati Birla, a physician and feminist people's health activist who has been engaged in anti-caste and anti-racist labor politics in India and in the U.S. Currently, she's completing her doctoral degree in sociology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Dr. Swati Birla, welcome to the Old Mole and to KBOO.
Thank you so much, Patricia, for having me here.
Today, the outbreak, which had been concentrated in larger urban areas like Mumbai and Delhi, is rapidly moving into rural areas, which are even less well-equipped to deal with the catastrophe. The official daily average number of new cases is hovering just under about 400,000, and about a quarter of a million people have died. But these numbers are widely understood to be a vast undercount of the actual number of cases. Swati, I'd like to start by talking about what's behind the undercount.
So, Patricia, there are a couple of reasons for the undercounting, and there are different ways in which the whole optics and the politics of it is playing out. One of the reasons for the undercounting has been complete denial on the part of the Modi administration. We had an administration that was completely underprepared for doing, you know, the contact tracing, as well as the counting of the people who are admitted into the hospitals and people who are actually dying away at home. Second, you have a system which actually has always undercounted. So in India, most people escape being counted as being born or dying. And that is especially true of people who are at the margins of the system. So the poorer people in the rural areas often do not get registered for birth or for death. So they enter the world and they exit the world very quietly. That quietness has actually become even more sort of prominent now, because what you're seeing is the dissonant sort of optics of it, people dying, burning in the graveyard. Your streets are now, all of them have been converted into graveyards. There is a consistent reporting from the central government that, one, not many people are tested, not many of them are COVID positive, and the last is not so many people are dying. Now, the pushback against the undercounting has come from various quarters, and you really see the way in which the state and the bureaucracy sort of works together in very horrific ways to create a certain kind of silence around death, and that creates a sort of a dissonance, but also a despairing anger. When citizens are taking the efforts to actually count death or to seek out for help, there has been a very consistent sort of repression of the people, either by calling on the Epidemic Act or different national security acts are being called in order to sort of repress people from reporting and from talking about the disease.
You mentioned an Epidemic Act. Is that legislation that was passed?
No, so this is an old act that is being reactivated in the current moment. Talking about the illness or talking about death has now become like an act against the security of the nation state.
How does all of this work in Modi's interest? Why is there so much repression of information going on?
I think the undercounting sort of plays out in multiple different ways in the interest of the current state. One, only 2 days ago, the Asia Human Rights Watch basically came out and talked about why the state is more interested in the image it has in the eyes of the international community than it has in actually counting or providing care for its people. There is a certain investment also coming from certain classes of people, both in the diaspora and in India, who are reluctant to see or reluctant to name the failure of the state as being part of the problem. There is a very strong sort of pushback against the undercounting. That pushback is coming from citizens who are talking about the multiple failures of the state. One of them being the fact that during this period, there were a couple of things that happened that have actually resulted in the current surge. One is the elections which have taken place both at the local and the state level, the open rallies, you know, the election rallies that have taken place, which have caused the surge to take place. The third is the fact that the state has basically encouraged, because of its own electoral interest and consolidating its constituencies in some places, to have festivities. There were, you know, a lot of, for example, Brahmins who were walking around in very close contact with each other to celebrate Hanuman Jayanti, which is the festival for the monkey god. And you also have very large sort of festivities, which is like the Mela, where you have hundreds and thousands of people accumulated in the river, near the river Ganges, to celebrate a festival which usually takes place every 12 years. But this time it was sort of brought forward by a year. And so that is a very steady constituency of Modi government. Many of these people actually do a lot of work during the electoral times to get votes out. So you have the electoral calculus or a calculation in mind, getting that vote and assuring your fate for the next 4 years, given all of the fiasco that is happening, was a very urgent situation for the Modi government.
So they were taking risks with the public health in promoting these electoral activities because they needed those electoral wins. What we read mostly in the Western press is that the outbreak was because the country had become too complacent, that the social measures that are needed to prevent the spread of the disease have been widely and prematurely abandoned. But you have a different take on what set the stage for this catastrophe.
I do not mean to say that the undercounting also has not taken place because of a complacency of the state. What the state did was that it silenced all of the scientific voices and citizens' voices as well, and created a certain sense of complacency in order for the elections and in order for business as usual. On April 30th, we had 300,000 cases, and the Ministry of Health is still putting out these weird videos asking people not to wear masks, not for social distancing, not for home care, but to drink tea with cinnamon and basil, or we have been watching really disturbing videos, basically in police stations, people being washed with cow urine. So there has been sort of a steady disinformation.
The other kind of factors had to do with this neoliberal project of Modi to dismantle
Yes.
a lot of the structures, the public health, the health services. Tell us a little bit about that.
One is, in the long term, what we have seen since 2014 is a systematic sort of gutting of the public health infrastructure. We already had a public health infrastructure which was doddering, but in the middle of the pandemic last year, the Indian state passed a budget for healthcare and for COVID provisions, which was only 0.34% of the GDP, which falls much short of what was required. Now, this is on top of a public health infrastructure, which is both completely sort of absent in many ways in the rural system as well as in urban care system. Almost 85% of the people in India do not have access to a consistent and a good quality government healthcare system or even a good private healthcare system. Hospital care being overwhelmed and not being able to deal with non-critical cases, and therefore these patients should be taken care of by their loved ones at home, is something that is coming from this argument that, you know, the healthcare system is overwhelmed. But the question is, why was the healthcare system overwhelmed? Why were alternative arrangements not made available? It would illustrate better if I told you about what the citizens were doing. Is that, for example, in the Muslim communities or in the Sikh communities, they have converted religious spaces, which are large spaces, to create a certain kind of either an oxygen langar, which is basically a community provision of oxygen, or community kitchens, or community healthcare system facilities. Masjids have been converted into doing that. So the way in which people are using existing sort of social structures and refashioning them in order to provide healthcare, which can be done in a more communal fashion, and therefore decreasing the burden to provide that kind of care. What the state could have done is made it a more centralized, systematic centralization practice, opened up schools, maybe opened up universities, which are now running as if they were normal. They could have sort of used many of these structures and repurposed them in order to provide care at that level. So there are many ways in which the state could have, in the short and the midterm, avoided the crisis, but it hasn't. It has chosen to systematically pursue, even in the middle of a pandemic, a more neoliberal or a capitalist agenda, which undercuts the system, which makes it impossible for it to respond.
This is probably a good place to talk about the vaccine program, because that was the shining star of Modi's administration. And the vaccination program in India is kind of dead in the water. So what happened there?
So there were two things within this whole business of the vaccine distribution. One was the fact that you had sort of created a near monopoly situation by making Serum Institute of India the sort of the main contractor. You also had a government institute like Hafkin that should have been sort of given more money than it was given in order to scale up the production. There is a lot made about the Indian vaccine diplomacy, and I really want to push back against that, because, you know, India did not gift away any of the vaccines. And that is not what creates the crisis for the people. India and the Serum Institute basically went on a path which would actually make sure that it maximized profits for them at the cost of, basically, each vaccine is available between 1,200 rupees to 2,400 rupees. What this means is you're asking someone who is incapable of earning that kind of money in a single month to pay about $4 to $8 per vaccine dose. So what the vaccine crisis in India is, both a problem of not scaling up production by creating more number of manufacturers, but also not acquiring those vaccines and making them freely available to people.
Narendra Modi has been trying to manipulate the image of what's going on in India throughout the crisis. But there's another way that I think the crisis has possibly worked in his interests, and that has to do with the relief organizations.
Patricia, what we're dealing with really is a mercenary party in control of a capitalist state. and in collusion with, you know, the corporate interest. Mm. This is a time when the government and also a lot of small and big operators that sort of feed into the system, from hospitals to, you know, the oxygen black market, and a lot of right-wing organizations across the country and in the diaspora. So what we're seeing right now is a sort of a disaster capitalism. So you have two different flows of money. I mean, other than the corporate contracts that have come in for cannulas and oxygens and so on, you have another two different sources of money that are completely unaccounted for. One is the PMO Care Fund, which a lot of international organizations have contributed to. Now, this fund is a $1 billion fund right now. It counters what used to be the Prime Minister's Relief Fund, which had some auditing, some accountability, some transparency. We have no idea where this billion dollar is going to go. We have no idea what is happening to it. And also, one of the things is that the BJP and its family of ideological organizations are the richest fascist organizations in the world.
BJP is Narendra Modi's, for our listeners, is Narendra Modi's party, right?
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
So BJP is the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the ruling party right now. The treasury of that party is by far the largest treasury in that entire South Asian political sort of scenario. But now the disaster funds or the COVID funds have become another source of income for that PMO Care Fund. The second funding that has come and that is going to sort of increase the right wing or the fascist strength in India in many ways is going to flow through these what seems like benign Hindu cultural organizations in the diaspora. What these groups do is collect both individual and other contributions in the name of COVID, and they channel them through a lot of grassroots sort of fascist or fascist front organizations in order to basically consolidate their constituency on the ground. And so you have this continued connection between the diaspora and the homeland and consolidating of the constituency, which will keep basically this right-wing government in power for some time to come. And that's what a lot of the COVID pandemic money is going for. And it is kind of really frightening to us what this will mean in terms of their powers to buy elections, their powers to repress.
What do you see for the possibilities for progressive forces in India? I mean, you talked a little bit about the springing up of some mutual aid organizations. And certainly Modi is very much a Trump sort of figure. And it's very clear in this country that Trump's handling of the pandemic was a big part of his recent electoral loss.
I must say that Modi is just so much more efficient than Trump is.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Trump's money that he collected during the pandemic doesn't come close to what Modi has been able to accumulate. So this is efficient fascism to another degree. Also, in the last 1.5 year, for example, there were about 6,000 people who were arrested for being against the national security. So various anti-terrorism laws have been used to raid people's houses and also arrest these 6,000 people. These are activists who are lawyers, human rights activists who have been arrested and are jailed. And some of them are also COVID positive. I mean, the jail situation as far as COVID is really horrendous. So what you have is a very repressive state that has made it very difficult for the left to operate. Now, in that circuit, you have a second thing which is happening is you have a lot of civil society organizations, NGOs, and also citizens' bodies that have sprung up because you need to ferry someone to the hospital. You need to ferry someone to get oxygen. You need to get community kitchens running. So these organizations have stepped up, but they have been strapped by the FRCA, which regulates foreign funding reception for a lot of the progressive organizations. Since 2014, but even before that, the Modi and Shah regime, when they were active in the Gujarat state, have followed basically a way of starving these NGOs of money, of getting any kind of external support especially. And so what you have is a state that keeps on expanding because of the amount of money it gets, and it makes it difficult for these organizations to exist because of lack of resources and because of repression. So movements are basically both thinking short-term and long-term, but they are extremely exhausted.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Swati Birla, and also want to tell our listeners that we're going to post some links on our webpage, the Old Mole webpage on the KBOO website, to organizations that they can donate to and have some confidence that their resources won't be appropriated by right-wing or fascist forces to further support and build the Modi apparatus there. So again, thank you very much for joining me today, and I hope we get to talk again.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
That was Patricia Kohlberg talking with Swati Birla. Did you know that only a small proportion of our listeners are actually donors or members? KBOO reaches a wide audience, but it needs support to continue to be the important part of this community that it is. This is the tail end of the spring membership drive. Please show your support by donating at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44-321. And now Bill Resnick talks with Howie Hawkins, Green Party candidate in the last election. In particular, they talk about the Biden administration's American Jobs Plan. Take it away, Bill.
Hi, Howie Hawkins. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Howie Hawkins was the Green Party candidate for president in the last election, was, to say it mildly, decisively defeated by Joseph Biden. Though on many, many issues, pollsters find a considerable majority of Democratic voters disagreed with Biden and agreed with Howie. Those issues include Medicaid for All that Biden opposed. The party's voters agreed with Howie on cuts in the military budget, not Biden. Howie supports a $15 minimum wage today. Biden wants a slow rise to 15. Howie sought to replace the police in many of their functions, replacing them with service and helping workers. Well, Biden called it defunding, which he refused to consider. So why then did so many progressives vote for Biden? Well, it's pretty obvious. You had to vote Biden to avoid Trump. What's the way out of that trap? Well, this country needs a voting system that allows voters to vote their preferences. Howie, the Greens, many others, Fair Vote, the organization, support what's called ranked choice voting. Every state and city in this country could adopt ranked choice for their elections. But that's not what Howie and I are going to discuss today, because climate science warns us that we're accelerating into a grave crisis of global warming. Oh, our corporate masterminds, they say, oh, they're just alarmists. In fact, climate science has been wrong over the last 40 years of more insistent warnings. They've been wrong in underestimating, however, the speed at which Judgment Day is approaching. Of course, Biden and his campaign has promised action. Unlike Trump, who tried to roll back even very small steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, Biden in his first 100 days proposed what appears to be a very big budget. Close to $2 trillion program, it's called the American Jobs Plan. It's directed substantially to climate action, but when you look at it, it's spread over 8 years, the $2 trillion, which is just $250 billion a year, which is about one-third of the yearly military budget that this country maintains. And much of it, like the military budget, is directed to the corporate apparatus. So Howie, give us your general impressions, your overall evaluation of the Biden administration's job plan.
Well, as a climate plan, it is really terrible. Why it's getting fanfare? Jobs, which is a big issue coming out of the COVID depression. And I don't really have a problem with selling climate action as a job creator. The problem is you look at the actual spending on climate within that $2.3 trillion, and it's only about $100 billion a year. That compares to what he promised during the campaign of $2 trillion over 4 years, which I still think is far below the scale we need to deal with this emergency. And then you look at the policies. They're terrible. They are pro-fossil fuels. Fracking will continue. They want to justify burning fossil fuels with carbon capture and storage, which is something that won't happen unless it's massively subsidized. subsidized because carbon dioxide is basically worthless, and pro-nuclear power, which is a big failed industry, pro-waste incinerators, pro-industrial biofuels, and the way he sneaks that in is he has a what he calls a clean energy standard instead of the renewable portfolio standards that many states have adopted, which focus on wind, solar, clean geothermal, energy efficiency, and those kinds of things. And he adds in all these dirty energy sources that produce carbon. So he's grandfathering them in. You might ask, did he get anything right? Well, the biggest climate investment is in electric vehicles. Sounds like it's big in scale, 500,000 charging stations in the next decade. But the analysts who look at that say we need 10 million. And then take housing. He says we're going to retrofit 2 million buildings for efficiency and heat pumps instead of fossil fuels to heat them. And you break that down, that's 250,000 a year. There are 120 million buildings in the country. That's 480 years to complete the program. That kind of shows that this is really not that serious as a climate action plan.
You know, I've looked at previous years, the Army Intelligence Unit, who does their projections of threats to the United States, I think it's every 2 years. They're enormously alarmist, in fact. In one of its scenarios, they think in the early 2030s, a global food catastrophe caused by climate events and environmental degradation prompts bottom-up revolutionary change. Polly, discuss a little bit with us why, in fact, being alarmist is being actually practical and quite reasonable.
Yeah, it's being realistic. That U.S. National Intelligence Council report that just came out in March is what refers to that global food catastrophe. You know, we shouldn't wait another decade before we're facing mass starvation and massive social unrest, possibly wars over water and food. It's a call to action. I mean, we've always used the analogy of the World War II emergency. You know, we need to do this not by providing incentives to the corporations that got us into this mess in the first place. We need to do it through the public sector. During World War II, federal government took over and planned a quarter of the manufacturing capacity of the country to turn industry on a dime into the arsenal of democracy to arm the Allies against the Axis powers. We need to do nothing less through the public sector now so we can plan the coordinated transition of all our productive systems to clean energy and zero emissions. And you're just not going to get that with a climate plan that is oriented to providing incentives, you know, tax breaks and subsidies to the corporate sector, particularly at a time when we face chronic overproduction. There are not that many profitable investment opportunities in the real economy of production. So you give them money and they invest in financial assets. I mean, that's what we've seen with the monetary expansion. This is sort of a Keynesian approach. The problem is, in a way, it's trickle-down economics as well, because you're counting on the corporations to make the right investments. And without the opportunities to do so, given the nature of this overproduction and stagnation, they're going to put it in financial assets and try to squeeze rents out of the economy rather than increase production. It's just the wrong approach. That's why we call for eco-socialist solutions. And, you know, at this time, the more progressive wing of the climate action movement is calling for what they call the Thrive Agenda, which is $10 billion over 10 years, but it's also oriented toward incentivizing the corporate sector rather than doing it through the public sector. You know, we advocated that with our eco-socialist Green New Deal. Bernie Sanders did to a pretty good extent in his Green New Deal proposal during the campaign. That's where we need to go, and I hope the climate movement will begin to realize, because we just can't throw money at corporations saying build clean energy and expect them to do it, particularly on a rapid time frame it needs to be done.
Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Howie Hawkins, the Green Party's candidate for president last fall. The Green Party has joined with others in a very realistic plan considering the grave danger that we face. We've been discussing the Biden jobs plan. It's extremely sensitive to the needs and desires of the corporate and banking apparatus that got us into our current predicament, and shows no sign of leading us out of it. It seems to me that there's emerging a corporate strategy for stopping uncontrolled climate change, and that strategy is technological optimism, that they can develop technologies that would vastly lower greenhouse gas emissions, like there's research into cows that don't fart methane, The machines that scrub the air of carbon dioxide and sequester it in deep caverns. There's a lot of money going out right now, even prior to the Biden plan from the Department of Energy and several others. Some of it going to the coal companies, those fine actors, to develop a carbon sequestration and storage. I find the worst part, though, of the plan, and that's likely to get a lot of money in the future, is the investor-owned utilities and their effort to maintain their profits and domination of the electric power industry. The big grid, the big continent-spanning grid that's being touted as smart and effective and efficient, and it's a mark of real modernity. It seems to me that that grid will never be built. And if it will, it will be immensely expensive and not very reliable. And that we have to really move towards the municipal and towards a confederated system of municipalities who are building out their energy system near the point of use, which can, in fact, be far more reliable than the big grid system and cheaper. Discuss that with us.
Well, the technological optimism, I think we can be optimistic with the technologies we have. Wind and solar are now cheaper right. than even natural gas, which has been cheap because of this fracking boom. So right there, that's what's cheaper. The problem is the investor-owned utilities, the incumbent energy companies, the coal companies, the oil companies, want to keep doing what they're doing because that's how they've been making money. So the investor-owned utilities, you know, they don't want to move off centralized power plants serviced by servo mechanical grids to a smart grid that can accommodate a distributed nature of wind and solar until they wear out the old grid, which is going to make it too late. So that's why power should be a publicly owned utility playing in the public interest, operated at cost and not for cost plus a profit for the investors. And in terms of carbon capture, we not only have to stop emissions, which this carbon capture from burning fossil fuels, that just captures it and very expensive to pump it into the ground. You got to build a whole nether infrastructure for that. You know, you got to pipe it to the right geological formations and so forth. But we can capture a lot of the carbon, because that's the other thing we got to do. We got to draw carbon out of the atmosphere because we're already at a level, 421 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere measured in early April when climate scientists say we have to get at least below 350 parts per million. So we not only have to stop emitting it, we got to draw it down. The way to do that is reforestation, rebuilding real living soils through regenerative organic agriculture, restoring habitats that are carbon intensive, like wetlands and mangroves. And that can draw a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere without, you know, building machines to grab the carbon and pump it into some cavern and underneath the earth. So I think the technology is there. And, you know, one problem with the International Panel on Climate Change report on 1.5 degrees centigrade or Celsius, to reach that, they assumed a slow drawdown of carbon emissions and then a ramp up of taking carbon out of the atmosphere with technologies they didn't specify, they said would be developed in the latter half of this century. That's too late. And that's assuming, you know, there's going to be some technology there. We already know that the potential for reforestation around the globe, rebuilding soils and other habitat restoration can draw enough carbon down to get us below 350 parts per million by the end of the century if we start now.
Howie Hawkins, one final thing. The question is, out of this Biden plan, which is really just a plan, it has to go through the arduous congressional process of enacting it and appropriating monies for it. There's going to be this enormous fight as to who gets the monies, because it is a lot of money, not as much as the military budget, but it's still huge. And almost every part of the corporate apparatus could, in fact, make proposals and make demands and have their congressperson on board, and especially if they're, of course, a Democrat, the powers that be, that we won't vote for the plan unless you give us $10 billion to the coal companies for carbon sequestration research. It seems to me that we're now in a struggle for that part of the plan will be enacted. I wonder if the climate action movement, the Greens, so many others, are readying themselves to unite with the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which is actually fairly large now. And their votes are absolutely necessary for Biden to come out of this looking like Roosevelt, which is what he sort of wants to do. What's your sense of the possibilities of actually winning not huge sums? We're not going to do it at once, but at least model programs that could be successful and to show the country that that's the model, the way to meet the threat.
Well, the Congressional Black Progressive Caucus is pushing this Thrive agenda, which is spending more money on these climate actions. You know, my critique of it is that it's still relying on the corporate sector. It's a Keynesian approach, not a socialist approach, which would involve economic democracy. So we have the power to actually push this through. And while I'm critical of it, I was out there marching with the Sunrise Kids a few weeks ago when they were demanding $10 trillion over 10 years. But you're right. In Congress, it's going to be a war with all these lobbyists, all these special interests. They now have the, what do they call them, where you bargain to get things in your district, member items. That's what they call them in New York State. There's a term for Congress, but they've reintroduced those. So there's going to be a lot of horse trading as this thing is hashed out in the next few months. And it's really the Democrats negotiating with themselves. The Republicans are irrelevant because they're going to say no no matter what. So it's really the Congressional Progressive Caucus dealing with people like Manchin out of West Virginia and Sinema out of Arizona and some other senators who have a lot of support from the fossil fuel industry. So we'll see what's going on. Meanwhile, you know, the climate action movement is focused on stopping new fossil fuel infrastructure, these pipelines, like Enbridge Line 3 being upgraded in northern Minnesota, the Dakota Access Pipeline. And their pipeline fights from the Mid-Atlantic to out there in Oregon, you know, that natural gas line to Coos Bay. So we can win those fights. We got Keystone XL stopped. We've won a lot of victories here in New York where I am. And we've expanded the bans on fracking a little bit. We got the Delaware Basin Water Commission to ban fracking in its jurisdiction. And hopefully we can expand those. I know in California, I think they said that after 2024, they're not going to permit more fracking. I think that's what Newsom said, the governor. So I think we can stop doing more harm. Those are victories we can win right now. But in the longer run, you know, the climate action movement needs to focus on system change, not just throwing money through the existing system. In other words, an eco-socialism where we have public enterprises and planning to build this clean energy economy. And without that public direction and coordination and accountability that you get with public enterprise and planning that's democratic, we're going to be in trouble. So we need a system change orientation, not just, you know, spend more money on it orientation.
Howie Hawkins, talk to you again soon. You're doing great work. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill Resnick with Howie Hawkins. It's time now for our regular feature, Another World is Possible. Here on AWP, Another World is Possible, we're still celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Paris Commune, which lasted in 1871 from March 18th to May 28th. I promised another episode on the Commune. We did a part one in April, but we had an extraordinary opportunity come up. So episode two on the Paris Commune will wait for next month. Our usual theme music for Another World is Possible is We Have the Guillotine from Boots Riley's group, The Coup. But in honor of the Paris Commune, where the women of Paris burned the guillotine, which you might remember from the first episode, we'll forego that particular music. Instead, I'm going to talk with Barbara Simons, author of a recent piece in the Journal of the Pacific Association for the Continental Tradition. Her essay is called New Narratives About Infectious Diseases Via Ecological and Systems Thinking. If that title sounds dry, the essay is not. And it turns out, Barbara has been listening to The Old Mole for years. Good morning, Barbara. Welcome to Another World is Possible on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much, Norm, for having me on your program. Program I have listened to for a very long time.
Ah, that's good to hear. You've written a wonderful essay that talks about the kind of premises that underlie the public healthcare system that we have in this society and premises that underlie a vision for what a different public healthcare system could be. The essay goes from that to connect the public healthcare crisis we face with the pandemic to a whole range of other issues that also are problematic in this form of social organization, and goes further to talk about the kind of insights that fiction can provide. I like the essay so much, and you've written it so accessibly that probably I'm going to end up quoting you back to you as we talk further. Let's start with the fiction aspect. We'll circle back to it. You end up talking about José Saramago's novel, blindness. Saramago himself is a Portuguese communist. I probably started reading him with your encouragement years and years ago. Blindness certainly came with your encouragement. It's a novel you've been thinking about for a long time. For now, let's begin just with the bare bones. What's the plot of Saramago's Blindness?
So the novel begins in a city on the day when people suddenly go blind with a certain form of blindness in which their vision is covered by a milky whiteness. Quickly, white blindness spreads like a virulent infectious disease to everyone in the population. Everyone except the main protagonist, the doctor's wife, who retains normal vision. Initially, the first blind people are quarantined in an abandoned mental asylum. Instead of being cared for, they are brutalized as directed by the military leaders until even the government and soldiers succumb to blindness. Amidst the chaos, a gang of white blind thieves and rapists take control in the asylum. With the leadership of the doctor's wife, the women organize themselves to successfully defeat this gang, and the asylum burns to the ground. The doctor's wife leads her small group of nine to flee the burning asylum and escape into the city. There, the survival of the small group of white blind depends on their efforts to organize themselves as a collective amidst the chaotic attempt by blind multitudes to find food and shelter. About a week later, when the entire population is on the verge of starvation, the novel ends as abruptly and mysteriously as it begins, when spontaneously everyone recovers normal sightedness. The characters wonder, what now? There is no closure to the riddles posed by the novel, and it is up to readers to figure out the significance of the pandemic of white blindness.
It's an allegory, blindness as an allegory, to enable Saramago to get at, to suggest even alternative modes of social organization. In any kind of understanding, it's the premises that underlie that understanding that are what's politically important, not the surface conclusions. Your essay is wonderful on looking at the kinds of premises that underlie, like I said before, the kind of public healthcare system that we do have. Here's a question that you posed in your writing. Is the rapid acceleration in the pandemic only due to widespread failures to implement public health guidelines as advised by the expert scientists in the outbreak narrative, or are there problems with the outbreak narrative itself? In other words, what are the underlying kinds of premises in the system we have, and are they problematic? Tell us a little bit more about the premises that you see that prevail now, and a different set of premises that could underline a much better, very different vision of what public healthcare should be.
The current responses to COVID have been based on what has generally been accepted as the outbreak narrative of infectious diseases, which is based on the germ theory of infectious disease. And the outbreak narrative is the paradigmatic narrative about pandemics that has dominated scientific and popular discourse since the 19th century. According to this narrative, when there is an outbreak of infectious disease, the goals are first, prompt laboratory identification of the germ that is causing the disease. Second, rapid testing to identify the pathogenic carrier, patient zero, in order to localize through contact tracing and contain the infection through quarantine to limit its spread to the rest of the population. And third, the development of a vaccine against the infection.
And so it's the germ's fault.
That's pretty much it, in sum.
Okay, and what would a different set of premises look like?
The alternative approach to public health care in response to infectious disease is really based on criticisms of the outbreak narrative. because contrary to the promises of cure and containment, the strategies of isolation and quarantine and the reliance on laboratory science actually exacerbate the effects of pandemics by further impoverishing those most vulnerable while deluding the rest of the population with the false idea that they are somehow protected from virulent microorganisms that spread without regard to artificial human borders of containment and that often mutate in response to vaccines and other drug therapies. For many decades, a growing number of doctors and other field workers, scientists, ecologists, and a range of activists have promoted alternative narratives about infectious diseases to counter the outbreak narrative. And they argue that the COVID-19 pandemic is the harbinger of future pandemics due to the intrusion of humans into the habitats of many species among whom microorganisms innocuously live. Therefore, they advocate for tracing the complex interconnections between human activity and viral spread in order to reorganize human life in sustainable and nurturing ways for entire populations of human and non-human living species.
Now, some of what I'm hearing then is a different premise as well that underlies what we currently have and what could a different way of thinking about public health be based on. We talked about the germ theory as a premise, that is, the responsibility for the pandemic is, you know, some agency out there that we simply have to identify and squash. You've raised another set of issues now, and that is, I guess we'll call it complexity, and your essay deals with this as well. And that is, we no longer can rely on analytic distinctions. We can somehow identify some small particular agency and isolate it and then act against it. But the problem is more systemic. You're now talking about how everything fits together. And if we're going to deal with problems, we have to be dealing with them in their large kind of context, rather, again, than some little thing, which is kind of a pun also, a germ that we can isolate and squash. So we've got two sets of premises now. One is something other than germs, but a mode of social organization. A second is that everything fits together. We've got to deal with things as a whole. What would that look like in public health?
It has to be, I think, for example, Paul Farmer, I think, is one advocate who is really important to follow. Ali S. Khan is another epidemiologist with just years and years of experience. But there's a number of these scientists and doctors, epidemiologists, and working with community activists. And I think this is the key point, is that Farmer, for example, is critical of the history of capitalism in which governments impose, in the name of this germ theory, and there's the science based on that, impose these harsh quarantines on populations to contain infectious diseases. Meanwhile, they don't provide the care that people in quarantine need in order to survive the virus. They also work hand in hand, these governments and the scientists work hand in hand to support the militaries and the economic interests, the corporations and the businesses and this, even the smaller groups, but who are really using the science in order to further their expansion and their economic pursuits. And I think that the science can never be separated from the politics. The science can never be separated from the values. The other way of approaching it, according to Farmer and Khan and so many others, is that we need to work together, community people, people on the local level, to empower themselves to use science in order to protect themselves from infectious diseases. But that has to go hand in hand with resisting the efforts to the poor housing, the poor sanitation, the poor nutrition, all of these other social problems that are intricately interconnected. it has to be dealt with so that people who fall ill have the support, this public health social safety support network that doesn't target the virus alone, but rather builds the support people need so that they can isolate themselves, identify who's sick at the same time they support those people.
It sounds very much like the plot of Blindness that you mentioned earlier, where those who are afflicted are simply isolated and stuck to kind of survive on their own, not taken care of, not integrated into some larger community.
Right.
Yeah, that is the practice now. You've said a lot, so I want to circle back to cover a bunch of things, give you a chance to expand on them. Right now, you've been talking about how effective public health relates to the expansion of democracy, basically, how we cannot have effective public health without that kind of expansion of community and popular kind of control. Going back to premises and the issue of premises, it's actually not a foreign concept around health. Our engineer for today's program has written extensively about polio and the changing conceptualization that underlies our treatment of polio. On the one hand, when doctors thought of patients as simply passive to be acted on by what turned out to be, of course, white male doctors, and what nurses brought, Sister Kenny in particular, an Australian nurse, brought the insight that the body itself can be integrated into the response to polio, can be part of the curative kind of process. A very different conceptualization, a very different premise about what was going on with the body and what was going on with polio. And last, you raised the issue of government. And so here I'm going to quote you to you again and give you a chance to explain what you meant just a little bit more. Here is Barbara Simons in the essay that mentioned, currently there is a tension between the implementation of effective public health measures and vaccination that strengthen the biopolitical power of current governments versus building fully funded public healthcare systems that serve everyone in an equitable and compassionate manner. You've made this point already very effectively in our interview, but just explain what you mean by government's biopolitical power.
Well, biopolitical power is the French philosopher Michel Foucault's term for his reconceptualization of the techniques of power developed with the rise of capitalism in the 17th century and extending into our current moment. There are two poles to biopolitical power. One pole is centered on the individual human body as a machine and involves disciplining the body's forces, optimizing its capabilities, increasing its docility and usefulness, and integrating it into systems of efficient economic control. This other pole of biopolitical power focuses on the species body and the biological processes of entire populations, such as births, the level of health, life expectancy, and longevity. This biopolitical power is affected through an entire series of interventions and regulatory controls over populations of people. The disciplines of the body and the regulations of the population are the two poles around which the organization of power over life has been deployed. Historically, biopower was an indispensable element in the development of capitalism. Beginning in the early 17th century, numerous techniques were developed for achieving the subjugation of bodies and the control of population, marking the beginning of an era of biopower. Today, biopolitical techniques of power are present at every level of the social order and utilized by very diverse institutions. These techniques of power act as factors of segregation and social hierarchy and guarantee relations of domination and the effects of hegemony.
And so the question is, what enables us to see alternatives to all that? See, I use very specifically because let's circle back to Saramago's novel, Blindness. Now we're talking about seeing the world anew, or what it is even that this pandemic makes visible. Last question for you, Barbara. What insights can be gained into these topics from fiction?
Broadly speaking, fiction is rich in opportunities to see the world in new ways and to imagine alternative trajectories into the future. And as you said, I think Saramago specifically experiments with the power of literary allegories. And allegories are stories that have a second and deeper level of meaning. Now, they're just, you know, allegories just abound throughout the history of literature, thousands of years of allegorical writing, and it's taking fiction and pointing out that second and deeper layer of meaning. And that may be moral, it may be political, philosophical, or religious. And another example, I think, of how fiction offers unique opportunities to see and imagine the world differently from the perspective of a scientist, a philosopher of science, which I find to be very interesting when paired with Saramago's literary approach to the power of fiction, is to look at what a scientist would have to say about the power of fiction, because you don't normally think of scientists as, you know, dealing with fiction so much as, you know, so-called facts. Well, the scientist and philosopher Isabel Stingers, she extols science fiction as a genre uniquely fitted to experiment with the power of scientific hypotheticals to cast a different light on the given world and to invent new hypothetical worlds. It's very exciting to think of the multiple ways. That's such a big question. Those are just a couple ways in which I think fiction is just where it's at, really. If we're going to imagine a new future for ourselves, you know, fiction is crucial. It's all about the imagination. We got to imagine something new. We're at a pivotal moment. We're going to take this in a new trajectory. Our imaginations mean everything.
This has been Barbara Simons emphasizing our theme, Another World is Possible. You quote Isabel Stengers in your essay, and she concludes by saying, our world does not need to be what it is. Another composition of the world is possible. Barbara is the author of a wonderful essay, New Narratives About Infectious Diseases via Ecological and Systems Thinking. Barbara, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
You're so welcome. Thank you, Norm, for having me.
Thanks to our guests today, Swati Birla, Howie Hawkins, Barbara Simons, and to the Old Moles, Bill Resnick and Patricia Kohlberg, and also to John Nelson and Denise Morris for their editing. And a special thanks to the KABU staff who've kept the station going under these strange and demanding circumstances. 80% of the funding for the station comes from listener memberships and donations. Please demonstrate your appreciation and support during our spring membership drive by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KABU to 44-321 or sending a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole. Stay safe and stay active.